And of course, our guest, Stephen Schwartz, as we talk about consciousness, life after death. I want to talk with him about reincarnation as well when we come back. And of course, let's take your calls and stories. Welcome back to Coast, Stephen Schwartz with us. Stephen, before we take the calls that keep rolling in here for you, let's talk a little bit about reincarnation as we touched upon a bit last hour. Of course, why do you think these souls regenerate again and come back? What's happening there? I mean, I always thought it was to reach perfection, off to heaven they go and they don't come back anymore. But what do you think's happening there?
Well, again, George, I think... You know what? I just take us back to where we began, and that is once you get that consciousness is causal, that's where you start. You don't start with matter. You start with consciousness. Then you realize that reincarnation is and survival is really telling us that there's a much bigger picture going on, and what it looks like is. There is an eternal aspect to us, that there is an eternal self. You might call it the soul. You could call it the logos of yourself, whatever words. I mean, it's not the term that's important, but the concept that there is an aspect of you that is outside of space and time, and that it periodically, for reasons which I think we're beginning to get a little handle on, manifests a personality. That is, you choose your parents, you choose your genetic makeup, you choose your socioeconomic background, you incarnate, you make a series of choices. This is about choice. And then you continue, and this is a recurrent event. You know, the research that was begun by Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, and I'm sure Jim's probably been a guest on the show,
yeah.
Shows that something very interesting that they reported, and that was that people whose lives ended in violence, particularly younger people, as if their lives were incomplete, tended to reincarnate in a relatively short space of time. About 15 to 20 months, as if they were coming back to finish something that had been begun. And so I think, again, you have to get back to this foundation, and that is we are consciousness. The body is a manifestation of consciousness. The eternal part of us is doing something that we at the personality level only dimly understand. The research, as I read it in any way, is that you and I are never coming back. That is, George Norrie and Stephen Schwartz are not going to be back. But the eternal aspect of George Norrie and Stephen Schwartz will, at its own time, for its own reasons, manifest other personalities. And that what comes across from life to life is memory. Remembered or strongly held patterns of belief and behavior. You know, the research that there's Ian Stevenson, before he died, did a book called Reincarnation and Biology, a two-volume book in which he was looking at birthmarks and wound marks that children brought over from other lives where they could validate it. I mean, one of the stories, for instance, is a young boy is born and he has this what looks like keloid tissue, like wound tissue, across on an angle across his back. And he says, I was a moneylender and I lived in this village that's a long way away from where his village was, and nobody in his village had ever heard of it or ever been there. And I was having an affair with a woodcutter's wife. And one day, as I was having relations with the woodcutter's wife, the woodcutter came home.
Not smart.
We heard him, and we tried to climb through the window, and he had his axe with him, and he killed me. And so they go to this, is there such a village? That's the first research question. Does such a village exist? Yes. They go to the village and they find out, was there ever a person of this name? Yes. What did he do? He was a moneylender. How did he die? Well, he was having an affair with a woodcutter's wife, and the woodcutter came home and killed him with the axe as he was climbing out the window.
Tommy.
And he, just where this boy bears this scar tissue. And so I think what's happening is that we have an information, we are an informational matrix, and that the events that occur as a result of the choices we make enrich this informational matrix, and we bring some of this over from life to life, because we are struggling with choices that we made, and we're picking new opportunities to begin to address these issues. And I think, again, it's really about consciousness. The modern analogy, I would say, George, is people, you know, there's a whole class, particularly in Japan, there's a whole class of guys who basically live in virtual space. They live in the what are called coffin hotels, these hotels where they live in these kind of tubes that they have stacked up that are not rooms, but it's a place with a bed and a television. And
right.
And most of the time, they are hooked up to, they're hooked up into gaming. And their lives really live in the gaming world. And as we develop increasingly sophisticated virtual reality so that we get full sensorium.
And we will. It's coming out pretty soon.
MIT has been announcing research on this. I've seen research on this from other, you know, private corporations. That's where we're headed. And I think, again, that will also be driven by the fact that with climate change, it's that we're going to have much less air flight because of the carbon burden that air flight puts in the upper atmosphere. So people are going to begin to have their business meetings not in physical space, but in virtual space.
And that's happening now too, Stephen, just with, you know, like Skype internet connections.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can see this process happening, this trend going on. You can see how, as this technology is developing so quickly, it's astonishing, you know, so that people can live more and more in virtual space. And well, that in a sense, that's kind of like incarnating, only you get to pick, you know, you get to pick your avatar, or, you know, who it is and what its attributes are and that sort of thing. And in its own way, I think that's a kind of simulacrum to reincarnation.
Stephen, let's take some calls here for you as they begin to line up. Gary's in Houston, Texas. Welcome to the show, Gary. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Fascinating discussion, and but my question is about climate change and particularly about the ocean rising. No one's ever explained why when you have ice and it melts, it takes less space than water. And I need some help understanding how if the Antarctica, you know, melted, that it's going to make the oceans rise when it actually takes up less space in the form of water than it would ice.
Well, because the ice was on land, so it wasn't it wasn't in the water.
Right, wasn't displacing water.
As the ice melts, the water that is released by that melt process flows into the oceans, and we're going to see, I mean, you know, Gary, it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, James Hansen, who really began the whole climate change research, I mean, he's now talking about 50 feet. Well, you can go online. I mean, do a search on sea rise. You can see interactive maps now that will show you what 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot, and so forth will show. I mean, the official report from the IPCC is now 20 feet. And some people are talking about 50 feet.
That would obliterate coastlines, Stephen.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, I had dinner when I was recently, I had to speak in Virginia Beach, and I had dinner with a person who's involved with the Norfolk government. And he told me that they had spent an enormous amount of money trying to protect one neighborhood in Norfolk against sea rise and that they were unable to do so. And they realized that they were going to lose about a third of the city. At the same time, in Hampton Roads, which is in Norfolk, the largest naval basin in the world, they're raising all the docks because they are beginning on high tides, they're beginning to go underwater. So they're spending millions of dollars raising the docks. If you look at, for instance, in Florida, I think the way you should begin to pay attention to this, Eric, is it will become impossible to get insurance along some coastal areas. And the result of this flooding is going to be a collapse of the most expensive real estate in the world, because some of the most expensive real estate in the world is along the coastlines. And, you know, people want beautiful views and to be on the ocean and all that. And, I mean, you look at a place like Malibu, for instance. I mean, you look at the projections of sea rise and the homes along the Malibu coast, they're just doomed. The same thing along parts of North Carolina or the Delmarva Peninsula on the eastern shore of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware.
Well, remember the map.
North Carolina.
Remember Edgar Casey's map of North America, which was all flooded out. Do you remember that, Stephen?
Absolutely. It's very interesting. Casey was making these predictions. His timing is off, but then we know from the remote viewing research that it's very hard for remote viewers to approximate time because it doesn't have the same meaning when they are doing remote viewing as it does when they are in a normal conscious state. So as this ice melts and flows in and we get this raid, I mean, San Francisco becomes a series of islands. The lower Manhattan goes under. It's just astonishing. Countries like Bangladesh are going to be just devastated, and we're going to see big migrations because these people, they're not going to all just lie down and die. They're going to move. We can already see this. I mean, if you look at the Middle East, you can see that underneath all of the other stuff that's going on is an enormous struggle about water and who's going to have water. That's dominating the thinking of all of these countries in the Middle East. And as a result of drought and lack of water, people move. Look at the Himalayan hydrology, the glaciers, which supply water to about 1.4 billion people. And as those glaciers melt, they're going to have first flooding, which is happening, and then they're going to have lack of water, drought. And so what are those people going to do? They're going to move. So we're going to have social disruption at a really massive scale. The same thing we now have, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 25 to 50 million food refugees, people who were living in areas where drought has made it impossible for them to grow crops, and they are now moving. So these big migrations, and in the United States, migration away from the coastline and out of the Southwest, I mean, cities like Tucson, Phoenix, Las Vegas, are going to have terrifically difficult times in the future if these projections about drought continue.
Let's go now to Mervin in Toronto, Canada, on the international line. Mervin, go ahead.
Hello, hi. Great show tonight. I actually have a story to tell instead of a question if I could tell Stephen. It's going to sound weird. It's an astral projection, out-of-body love story. And what happened was I had a dream one night where most of my dreams end up being murky. Like, it's like you see in a movie where basically it's black and then it starts to dissolve into, you know, open daylight. And I had a dream about I saw what turned out to be my soulmate. And what happened was that basically she called out and said, "I think I see my soulmate standing in front of me." But what happened was that I end up being a living portrait. It's kind of like from Ghostbusters, Viggo the Carpathian. It's kind of like that, where I couldn't do anything. And she didn't realize that I actually was looking at her the whole time. And she took, you know how some people take off their glasses to look at a person more closely if they're interested in them or they're looking at the portrait? And what happened with that was, with me, is that I kept looking at her, but she didn't realize I was staring at her the whole time, and I was so elated to see her that I just wanted to do anything possible. But what happened was that my spirit ended up pulling me back to my body, where another person came into the picture, and they looked at me, and then they looked at her, and then she put back her glasses on, and she ended up looking very disappointed at the person that she was standing in front of her. And I grabbed the person's hand. It was a gentleman. And he looked back at me, and he nodded his head as if, like, your time, like, it's almost as if he was telling me, like, your time will come. And I just kept pulling back and pulling back. So to me, it kind of felt like that Matrix John Carter effect, where, you know, your body's in one place, and then you astral project into another place, and you live in one place, but you can't do anything until you come back to your original spot. I actually wanted to know, even though with my story being said, and it sounds very weird and odd to be telling it, I'm comfortable telling you to you both, gentlemen, and to everybody else who's listening. I wanted to know, would you both actually think about it, and is it very peculiar to have a dream in that way? Because I don't honestly think it is, but it's nice to have something like that. But I just wanted to know what you guys have to say.
Well, is it Marvin? Is that right?
His name's Mervin.
Mervin. Well, Mervin, I will tell you, as I was listening to you, that's a fascinating story, by the way. I was reminded, years ago, I spoke in Pittsburgh at a research conference, and I was talking about these, about dreams. I was doing a lot of dream research at that point, and I was speaking about dreams not unlike yours. And afterwards, this very dignified, probably 60-year-old psychiatrist came up to me, and he said, I have this story. I've never been able to tell it to anybody, but I want to tell it to you. And he said, when I was a younger man and I was in medical school, I had a dream that I was going to class. And I had this dream over and over again. And next to me was sitting a woman. And over in the dream, we began to interact over this was a recurring dream. And finally, we made an appointment to meet at a museum. And he said, I felt that very foolish. But I went to the museum in Pittsburgh, and there she was. And he said, and I married her, and I've been married to her now for 25 years, and I've never told anybody this, and I still don't understand it, but it's very clear to me that there was some kind of connection between us that was so strong, and when I was in a dream state and relaxed, and my inhibitions about this sort of thing were relaxed, that I actually met her, and he said, you know, and we've been married, we have two kids now, and
Stephen, that happens a lot. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with Stephen Schwartz as we talk about dying consciousness next. Welcome back to Coast, Stephen Schwartz with us. We'll get to your final calls as well. Stephen, thanks again for coming on the program. You're always a delight.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, George. You are a very highly intelligent man who asks good questions. It's a great show, and no wonder it's so popular.
Oh, my gosh, it just keeps growing and growing. So tell me, what about intention experiments? Have you ever tried to conduct intention experiments? I'm thinking we need to do something to make it rain in Washington where you are.
yes, I've done actually a fair amount of research on intention. It is the key to the whole business. The capacity to hold intention-focused awareness. There's a reason why every martial art, every spiritual tradition has some form of some technique for holding intention-focused awareness. Meditation, some mindfulness technique, some vision quest technique. And the reason is we know from the actual research, for instance, that meditators do much better at tasks which involve non-local consciousness than do non-meditators. They make better remote viewers, they make better healers. And the reason that that's true is that they have the ability, they learn the ability, and it is a learnable skill, to hold intention-focused awareness. Now, if you look at someone like Roger Nelson's Global Consciousness Project, where he's measuring changes that amount basically to changes in the force when some event occurs that coalesces the consciousness of large numbers of people in a highly emotional way, the death of Princess Diana, the tsunami in Japan in 2011, the funeral of Nelson Mandela, that kind of thing. When there is some kind of an event which causes people to focus in intentioned awareness on some event, particularly if it has an emotional component, what Rogers found is that his random number generators, which are by design supposed to be random, that's the way they're built, they go non-random because there's some kind of fluctuation. So could we cause change if we could get large numbers of people to hold focused awareness? Well, it's hard to do the research because there's so many variables that are involved. You know, Years ago, I tried with the help of an assistance of the Los Angeles Police Department. I wanted to see whether claims that meditators could lower crime rate if a bunch of people meditated in a particular neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that I could never get control of all the variables. You know, if one guy parked a car on the street and somebody broke the windshield, well, then studies will tell you that crime will go up in that neighborhood until that car is removed. And there was just no way to control for everything. But I think we can see this intention thing work. And I'll give you three examples of this. Look at the shift between gay and LGBT. Now, nobody passed the law. No one came out, no one in official capacity came out and said, from now on, we will say LGBT instead of gay. But you can do a search on the Google word search, and Google will tell you how frequently words appear. And what you'll see is that about a year ago, something happened. And people began to use the word LGBT instead of gay. And that's not just a change of term. That's also a change of concept.
I think social media does a lot with that.
I think social media is a terrific force in this. You can see this in
marijuana
legalization. You can see this in marriage equality. Why did those things change? There was this huge shift in consciousness, and the answer is because people make individual choices. They hold intention-focused awareness in a new way, and when that happens, then there is fundamental change. So I think it's pretty clear that if you could get enough people to focus on something and hold it really in intentioned awareness for a period of time on a regular basis, that you could produce measurable effects. But it's a very difficult experiment to try to do because you have so many variables in the world that you can't be sure, you know, is this what actually caused it or is there something else? But if you look at these examples that I just gave you, you can see how this happened. I mean, I'm very struck by this.
Sure. I mean, if I were to say, folks, concentrate on rain over the state of Washington, is that strong enough?
Well, you know, it would be a very interesting experiment. You have millions of listeners. And so if you said to all your people, if you'll spend 20 minutes a day focusing on rain occurring on the mountains where the fires are occurring in Washington, and you do this for 20 minutes every day for, say, 3 weeks, I would be very interested to see what happened.
Me too. Why 20 minutes? Why not 5 minutes?
Well, because most of the research suggests that it takes about 20 minutes to get into a state of focused awareness to do this. I mean, you can do it in less, but for most people, it takes a while to get into it. You know, meditation is both the simplest thing and the hardest thing to do because it's hard to sustain it. But I think it's a wonderful idea. It's a great experiment.
Yeah, I think we should try.
Your listeners, you got millions of them. We're all going to hold 20 minutes a day for 3 weeks that rains will come to the central and eastern side of the Cascade Mountains, and let's see what happens.
Let's do it. Let's make that official.
Good.
Concentrate, great. And let's see what happens. Let us know, Stephen, what might happen. Now, here's my other question, then we'll go to final calls here for you. Would it be easier for millions to do it, or just one individual who's got strong mental abilities?
Well, I think what happens, George, is one person who has a very strong experience. That person sets in motion other people. That's why people coalesce around teachers and form religions. So if you have one person who has a particularly focused, a particularly strong capacity to hold this intentioned, focused awareness, other people will be drawn to that. And you can see this in for instance, things that the Dalai Lama has done,
mm-hmm.
where you get lots of people who get interested in that and they focus on it. I think this is an area where we need to do a lot more research. The research is just not there yet. And as I say, trying to control all the variables, but what we do know, if we look at the Global Consciousness Project, for instance, is that where large numbers of people hold intentioned, focused awareness, there is some kind of fluctuation that makes the random number generators go non-random, and that suggests that coalesced consciousness by numbers of people, particularly if there is a strong emotional component, has the ability to change the structure of society.
Back to the phones now we go. Dennis is in Philadelphia. Dennis, go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask your guest, what does he think about hypnosis in regards to finding out one's past life?
Past life regression. I think it works. Stephen, your thoughts?
Hypnosis is a technique for holding intentioned, focused awareness. And when you can do that, you can open to the eternal part of yourself. And so I have seen some very compelling stuff about past life regression. I knew the original researchers that were doing it. So I think there's something there, A. B, there's a lot of research on the ability of intention-focused awareness augmented with hypnosis, that it can have a substantial effect on the physiology of the body. You know, we're now looking in meditation. Not only do meditators change the structure of their brains, research shows that, for instance, 11 hours cumulative, that's just 20 minutes a day cumulative to 11 hours, causes a thickening of the prefrontal cortex. And there was just a study just published less than a month ago, which showed that meditators have the ability to literally alter their DNA. I close with what I began, and that is, once you begin to think that consciousness is the fundamental, and you begin to work with consciousness, you can alter the structure of space-time.
By doing that, do you alter anything else?
Well, we don't know what the limitations are, or even if there are limitations. Clearly, where you get large numbers of people coalesced. I mean, you know, for instance, Jung said, I think this is very important, they asked him, how did Hitler rise to power at, you know, one of the highest, most advanced civilizations in Europe, how did they become involved with this strange man? And his response was, Hitler did not lead the German people. Hitler was the German people. He was the projection of the pain and resentment that arose after the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War. And he said, until you get that, you don't understand how a man like that could come to lead the German people. He didn't lead them. He was the personification of their dark anger and resentment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Hitler had the ability to mesmerize these people.
Absolutely. Albert Speer, who was his this leading minister, did the construction, architect, all that. Albert Speer said, when all of us, no matter how powerful we were in our own realms, when we went in to see the Führer, our hearts dropped into our pants.
Did they think they were going to get killed or what?
They just were completely overpowered by the charisma of his personality, his beingness.
That's because they knew at any moment he could have people kill them.
Yes, that
he was insane.
Yes, that's also true. But let me actually, as we're coming to the end, let me just tell this Gandhi story because that's much more positive.
All right, this is okay.
Gandhi, before he was killed, before he was assassinated in 1948, a reporter went up to ask him, and the reporter said, "My editor sent me up here to just ask you one question." And he said, "Well, what's the question?" And he said, "How did you force the British to leave India? They'd been here for 300 years, longer than the United States has existed. How did you force them to leave? You have no official position. You have no money. You have no army. How did you get what was then the strongest power on the planet? How did you force them to leave?" And Gandhi's answer makes this point that we're talking about. He said, "It isn't what we did that mattered, although that mattered. It isn't what we said that mattered, although that mattered. It was the nature of our character that made the British choose to leave India."
That's so true. Kannapolis, North Carolina, it's Robert Stern on Coast to Coast. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering about like a collective mental thing. When I was younger, I'm 32 now. This is before the internet and everything else mm-hmm. was really popular. I remember I used to be sitting in my house and I'd think of a friend, and like a minute later the phone would ring and my mom would go to pick it up and I would say, "It's for me." And even mm-hmm. up into my probably mid-20s, I had one friend and I'd talk to like maybe once a year, every 6 months. The only time I ever contact them was, it turns out, when I would contact them, they were really upset and down in the dumps, and it just turns out that was, they would pop in my head and I'd be like, "You know what, I'm talking to mom, I'll call them." And that was when they were in their worst state. Like, how do you feel about like a mental connection between friends and people, or even when you're younger, because it was a lot stronger when I was younger, then I'm at 32 now, I don't get that at all.
Well, I can tell you that, for instance, if you look at the research of English biologist Rupert Sheldrake, he has been doing exactly the experiment you are describing. That is, people focusing and telephone calls coming in and knowing who's calling. Or you could look at the work of William Broud, who began, and now other people have replicated this, who began a series of studies in which he would put a person in one room and they would be reading a magazine. They would be hooked up, excuse me, to an EEG.
Sure.
And another person of some distance away, the person sitting in the room reading the magazine or whatever, what they didn't know is that they had a video camera shining, pointed at them. And the person in the other room was looking at a monitor, and most of the time it was just noise, just, you know, white noise, but periodically at a random number generator controlled basis, a picture of the person would appear on the screen. And what William reported was that when those people, when the picture appeared and the person stared at them, stared at the television screen, not at the person, at the television screen, the person who was some distance away sitting in a room, their brain activity altered to reflect that they were being stared at. I mean, we all have this experience of pulling up to a stoplight and feeling like somebody's staring at us, and you look over and there they are.
looking right at you.
Yeah, your experience is actually been replicated under experimental conditions. Clearly, where there is a strong emotional connection, there is some kind of linkage that goes on between friends. And you had that direct experience. But as you get older, other factors come into play. You have more demands on your time. Your job gets more complicated. I mean, just life takes you away from that ability to focus. But you could regain that. You can go to Rupert Sheldrake's website. Just do a Google on his name. And he's got an active experiment going on right now on just this issue.
Is it the brain or is it consciousness? 30 seconds left, Stephen.
It is consciousness interacting with the brain. We don't quite know how it happens. It may be a quantum mechanical process, but there is some way in which consciousness enters into space-time.
Amazing. Stephen, thanks for being on the program. Let's keep in touch, okay?
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, George.
Stephen Schwartz, his works, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. On our next program, Craig Hewlett joins us for a couple hours as he tries to put all these world events into perspective and how they affect all of us, followed then by Winfrey, the creator gods of the physical universe. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.